Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
Our press secretary gave alternative facts to that.
My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful.
Welcome to Unspun, the podcast that makes you better at finding the truth. The way people get news is changing. It used to be that there were many reporters who would research stories and write articles, but now politicians and famous people share information directly with you on social media and the internet. That means you find out things fast, but it's up to you to make sure the information's actually accurate. And newsmakers don't always do their part. The temptation to manipulate information is strong. They bend the truth to deceive so that they can avoid accountability, so that they can advance their agendas. When you recognize these agendas, you can sometimes find out what's real. And we're at a crossroads where anyone can share anything online, so it's important to sharpen your critical thinking skills. Finding that deception before it goes viral is pretty much a survival skill now, and we're going to do it together. Let's get unspun. Hello, Truth Seekers, and welcome to this week's Unspun. We have an exciting episode for you today around some really important issues as we're just 1 week out here in the U.S. from a big election. We're going to look at the issues with AI-generated deceptive information for elections, and then my guest, PolitiFact founder Bill Adair, and I are going to talk about who is more deceptive in their communication, conservatives or liberals, how that happens, and what it all means. Sound good? Let's get unspun.
Like Bill Cosby was the victim of an Illuminati conspiracy. And climate change is a hoax, just like 9/11 and Pearl Harbor. And wicked people need to be killed. I speak for women when I say that as soon as a female gets pregnant, it's not her body anymore. I speak for African Americans when I say that the civil rights movement was crap. And when I speak to school shooting survivors, I say, shut up, you spoiled little bastards. I've been bankrupt repeatedly, failed to pay taxes, and been convicted for writing bad checks.
The voice you heard was sort of Mark Robinson, who's running for governor of the U.S. state of North Carolina. Or was it? It turns out that those are Robinson's words, but he didn't say them that way, and in that order. They were put together using artificial intelligence with an AI voice duplicator. And they're part of an ad series that has played in the state and been kind of controversial. I mean, is it okay to do that? The person who created the ad series says that because they were actually Robinson's words, even though he took them from print and turned them into voice, it's okay. Plus, the person labeled the ads with statements about the fact that the audio is a parody or fake in some way. But you know, even with that disclaimer, is that okay? Consider that the content of the ad could be taken without context. And once you've made that for someone, they can clip out the part where Robinson seems to be saying things and put it in an entirely different light. And I don't know about you, but if that were me, I would not be very excited about that. But that is some of the world that we find ourselves in now. So today, I thought we might play a game in place of today's warm-up. First, I want to be clear that this is not just an American issue.
We have developed an investment platform that we believe can help every Canadian safeguard their financial future, even during periods of inflation. They simply need to visit our website.
The voice that you hear sounds like Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has an affection for investment strategies, but unfortunately, that's not actually Justin Trudeau at all. It's a deepfake. It was such a good one that it actually scammed an Ontario man out of thousands of dollars. Here's another example.
This innovative program is designed to give each and every one of you the chance of a steady and high income.
In that case, it was British Prime Minister Keir Starmer. I apologize that all of these examples are from the English-speaking world, but since this podcast is in English, I feel like they'll be understandable to most of you truth seekers. Now, the Brennan Center for Justice is warning that AI could even be used for voter suppression, specifically targeting certain groups and, you know, especially minority voters. You think about, you could maybe manipulate polling place locations, give false information about the requirements to actually cast your ballot. You could create a huge line at some poll places, and it could also be used to make fake evidence of voting irregularities, you know, just make stuff up for people who want to accuse the whole system. Before the election, it could make people stay home and just not vote. And after the election, we could have January 6th, the sequel. And of course, this is not just an American problem. The UN has looked into it and has been working on the problem for a while and is calling for, you know, international cooperation, basically developing ethical guidelines for AI. A global problem with global solutions. I thought it would be good to explore this issue with an audio test. So I'm going to play for you several audio clips of me discussing deepfakes. I want you to know that I spent $11 and I took an hour of my time to create a clone of my voice through something called 11 Labs. One of the clips you listened to was recorded by me. One of them is a clone of my voice with the 11 Lab clone, and one is from an interview that I did with a local TV station. And let's see if you can tell the difference between them. Let's start with the first clip. Okay, so at least voters know what they're seeing, whether it's real or, you know, cooked up. An algorithm, right? But even those laws have some limits. For example, Texas has a law that only covers deepfake videos, but not other kinds of media. It seems like they're playing catch-up with a really fast-moving target. And it's a tough challenge, but there are some interesting approaches. Like Minnesota. They've gone with escalating the penalties for distributing deepfakes, kind of like strikes. The first time it's a misdemeanor, and the second it's a felony. And then you've got Colorado, and they've taken a more, shall we say, financial approach. Kind of a hit where it hurts, in the wallet. So they can slap offenders with a civil penalty of 10% of what they spent on the deepfake ad. So if you spend $1 million on a fake ad, get ready to cough up another 100 grand. That's the idea. And maybe that would make people think twice. That was the first clip. Now here's the second one. Disenfranchising voters, that's a major concern. Really, just chilling stuff. And what about the election process itself? Could I mess with that? Definitely a possibility. Imagine AI-powered systems creating huge lines at certain polling places or generating fake evidence of voting irregularities that are likely to cause chaos and make people lose faith in the whole system. Undermining confidence in the results, the process, everything. This is heavy stuff. And it's not just a U.S. problem, right? This is global. The UN has actually been sounding the alarm about the potential impact of AI on elections worldwide. And we'll move on to the third clip.
You can actually put stuff into videos or into photos that wasn't there to begin with, but you can also kind of make something whole cloth out of nothing. Democracy depends on having an informed electorate, right? And being an informed electorate, it just got a lot harder.
The first clip was me recorded for this show, for this episode. The second was created with my voice clone in 11AI, and the third was from the TV station. How did you do? Was this easy? Would it be easy if you didn't know you were taking a test and it was just going by you? That's some of the risks of AI when it comes to elections. I need to take a quick break, but when I come back, you will not want to miss my conversation with PolitiFact founder Bill Adair. He's got a new book that makes some striking claims about who creates the most political disinformation based on actual data, and you're not going to want to miss it. I'll be right back. My guest this week is Bill Adair. Bill is the Knight Professor of the Practice of Journalism and Public Policy at Duke University in North Carolina. He's the creator of the Pulitzer Prize-winning website PolitiFact and has been a real leader in fact-checking and digital media for a long time. He's also worked as a reporter and editor in Tampa Bay and in other places, and we're really happy to have him here on Unspun. Bill, welcome to Unspun. I'd like to start by saying that in some ways, from the subtitle all the way through, your book seems really brave to me. So I wanted to start with maybe a quick story from my end. So I'm a journalism professor down the road at Elon, and my students this semester are creating a voting guide for Elon students who are voting absentee at home, right? So they're from New Jersey, but going to school in North Carolina, but voting in New Jersey, that kind of thing. And so they're including candidate views on issues that we learned are important to students from focus groups that we did on campus. And one of the things we talked about was if we should include fact checks or statements from the campaigns, or probably fact checks of statements from the campaigns. And interestingly, almost to a student, my students thought that if they included open fact checking on their site, that would be off-putting to readers because they would think that was bias on my students' part. So on the one hand, that makes me very sad to think that fact-checking in itself could be seen as bias. On the other hand, though, I think, you know, maybe they're not wrong. And so that reminded me of some ideas in your chapter that you called working the refs. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the idea of just reflexively complaining that the deck is always stacked against you by the media and maybe how that's being used for political advantage.
Well, first, thanks for having me. And I'm glad you feel the book is courageous. I'm troubled to hear that they perceive that people might think fact-checking is biased. But I think they have a good sense of reality. And I think we have reached a situation because there has been so much criticism of fact-checking, primarily from the right, that fact-checking has an image problem. And I talk about this in the book. You mentioned the chapter Working the Refs. And indeed, that begins with an interesting scene that goes back to the early 1990s when Rich Bond, the chairman of the Republican Party, reveals really the strategy of the Republican Party in working the refs, and he likens it to what he did as a Little League coach, which makes me never want to coach a Little League team against Rich Bond. Because he obviously plays to win. But I think your students are perceiving what has happened in the electorate, particularly among conservative voters, because they've been told over and over again that fact-checking is biased. And that's just not true. As a general rule, I think fact-checkers work really hard to be nonpartisan and to fact check both sides fairly and to use sources from both sides. And but from the right, there's been just this constant drumbeat of criticism. And so it's understandable, I think, that people on the right feel that way. So what can we do? I think we need to get more fact-checking by organizations on the right, and that's one of the things I talk about in that chapter, that we need more conservative organizations like The Dispatch, which is a conservative publication that does fact-checking and has found that readers really appreciate it. So I used to say, my friends at Facebook would say, you know, we need more conservative fact checkers. And I would say, there's no such thing. You know, fact checkers are independent and you can't have a liberal fact checker or have a conservative fact checker. Well, you don't, in the sense that you don't want, like, everyone should fact check the same. You would hope that a conservative fact checker and a liberal fact checker would reach the same conclusion. But they were right that we need conservative publications to do fact-checking more than they do now. And this was one of the surprises to me when I started PolitiFact. I thought that within months of us starting PolitiFact in 2007, that Rupert Murdoch would start a fact-checking organization at the Fox News Channel. I thought I even came up with a name for them. I thought they would call it Fox Facts, and that didn't happen. So I think your students are perceptive, and it's a problem that we need to deal with.
I want to follow up a little bit and ask, so do you kind of personally feel like writing this book and saying out loud right on the cover that Republicans lie more was brave? Did you think about if it might change the size of your audience or how effective what you wrote was?
I wasn't concerned about changing the size of the audience because I really wrote this book not to sell books, but to say something. I was more concerned with speaking up and saying something that I had avoided saying for many years. Is it brave? I don't know. I'll let other people judge that. But I, I think it needs to be said. And, you know, I begin the book with a scene of me on C-SPAN. And I'm on, this is 2012, and I'm on a great C-SPAN program I love doing called Washington Journal. I'm talking about our fact-checking and the promise tracking that we did. And it's a call-in show. So people call in on the Republican line, on the Democratic line. And so on the Democratic line, there's a caller, Brian from Michigan. And Brian from Michigan says, "Hey, Mr. Adair, I read in The Nation that Republicans lie more. Is that true?" And I say, "Oh, Brian, we don't keep score. That would be like asking an umpire who's out at home more, the Red Sox or the Yankees." Well, I was lying. We did keep score. We kept score by politician. And I knew that Brian was right. But I lied because I didn't want to acknowledge that reality. No fact checker does, because fact checkers need to appear impartial. And they don't want to acknowledge the truth of this because they need to cover both sides and do it in a neutral way. And so there's no way that any fact checker today would want to answer that question. And so I actually, when I began writing the book, I was like, those fact checkers, they need to answer this question honestly. And now I'm like, you know, I get it. I understand why I lied. And I actually have a solution for this problem. I think we do need to face up to this asymmetry in lying. It's huge. Republicans lie so much more than Democrats do. So what does that, how do we go about showing people that score? Should that be up to PolitiFact? Should that be up to the Washington Post fact checker? I don't think so, because I do think they need to be the umpires who just make the calls at home plate. So what is the, so how do we reveal that total score? I think we need to have some independent organization like a university or an independent group that tallies up the total fact checks and provides that. You know, here's the total count for each party. You know, I could even envision it. I'm in New York City today, and I could even envision that like up on a sign that says, you know, here's the number of fact checks so far. Here's how many false ratings Democrats have gotten. Here's how many false rating Republicans have gotten. And so I think that would be useful, but I wouldn't expect the PolitiFact editor or the Washington Post fact checker to be going around the country saying Republicans lie more. They're still doing it. You know, like that's not realistic.
So one of the things that I really liked that you did was you sort of went through a kind of a definition of different ways of lying. And then you gave several examples of lying through the years, including a lying hall of fame. And so your lying hall of fame, you know, did include both liberal and conservative politicians. But one of the things that made me think about, because it did have kind of a historical bent to it, was if the sort of factualness of the information ecosphere is worse now, or does it just feel worse because social media kind of makes the lies echo more?
I think you're exactly right. I think social media, it makes the lies explode in ways that they never did in the past. It unites liars. It spreads them with lightning speed. It allows different parties to sort of look over at like-minded individuals and be like, oh, yeah, those are the talking points for today. Okay, FEMA's not getting the resources to Western North Carolina. Got it. I'm gonna use that lie today. And so that's possible today, and it wasn't possible in the past. If in the age of newspapers, I sound like an old guy, and wire machines, you know, that wasn't possible with the scale and speed that it is today.
Yeah, that's funny. I describe that to my students as the days when dead trees would show up at your house with words on them. But yeah.
Yes. And you know, those days had benefits and drawbacks. I mean, I make the point to my students that when there were fewer outlets, they acted as filters to filter out misinformation in valuable ways. So that was good. So and I was part of that filter. When I was a teenager, I worked for the local newspaper and I opened the mail. And so we would get letters from people with crazy theories, and I would put those aside, and the city editor would look at them and throw them away. So like I was part of the filter that threw away the conspiracy theories. Now those people who write those letters, who might have lived in different parts of Phoenix, Arizona, where I work, they had no way of getting together back then. Now those people can meet on the internet instantly and sort of get each other excited and be like, hey, I got this. And then the other guy's like, yeah, that's great. You know, and so those people from all over the country, maybe all over the world, are like getting together and spreading this stuff. So it's so efficient at bringing conspiracy-minded people together. And that's, you know, the internet is wonderfully efficient. Now, drawback. Back in those days, you had few news organizations. Most were run by white guys. So, you know, there were drawbacks to that. A bunch of like-minded people making news decisions. So lots of voices never got heard. Lots of perspectives never got heard. So there were plenty of drawbacks to that also.
Yeah, different kind of echo, I guess. So, you know, I started my journalism career back in the days of dead trees with words on them. And I remember at that time that you really wouldn't say that a public figure had lied, right? You would say they were incorrect or they misspoke, or you'd come up with some other nice euphemism for that. I think New York Times even this week used untethered to the truth for that. And then kind of in early 2017, you started seeing things were so obviously demonstrably not true, right? Like this was the largest inauguration in history and there's pictures and you can kind of see that it wasn't. I actually got in touch with some of my graduates working at newspapers to ask them, what is your newsroom doing language-wise with stuff like that? So my question for you is, do you think that the media was adequately prepared for sort of a big lie presidency?
Well, I think not only a big lie presidency, but I think we were unprepared for this this asymmetry in the parties. You know, the political journalism has always been based on the concept of evenness. Like, okay, I'm going to talk to this party and they're going to behave roughly the same way as the other party. And there was just this kind of expectation of regular order, which is a phrase for bills in Congress, but I'm going to use it here in a different way. But there was just this sort of expectation that there was evenness, and including evenness in terms of the amount of lying, the amount of corruption, you know? So it's not like, you know, when I was coming up in journalism in the late 70s, 80s, I guess it was the 80s, that we were like, man, this party is really worse. Like, yeah, they were both about the same in ways in terms of corruption. I don't think there was any perception back then about one party being worse for lying. So so the media had this expectation for decades about evenness. So along comes Donald Trump, building on what had been years of his party becoming a bigger liar. So Donald Trump didn't turn the Republican Party into the party of lying. It had already begun, you know, and I had noticed it in covering Congress in like the early aughts. And so by the time Donald Trump came along, with the birther lie in 2010, 2011. And actually, the birther lie really started in 2007. But, you know, there was the Republican Party was sort of well on its way. We had lies about Obama and his origins. Then we had lies about Obamacare. Obamacare is a government takeover of healthcare, whatever. So, but the media unprepared for this. Like, wait, what's happening here? Like, you know, one party is lying a lot more than the other. So, no, the party was not ready. I mean, the media was not ready for this. And today, still, the news media is still flummoxed by this, you know, and often gets criticized harshly by people who complain about both sidesism, a wonderful word that seems to be like three words, where, you know, they've taken that the media tries to be fair, but in doing so doesn't reflect the truth. Because they're like, they talk to one side and like, you know, well, you know, the earth's not really warming. Yeah. You know what? The earth is warming. So like, get over that both sidesism stuff on that issue. So anyway, no, the media wasn't ready for Donald Trump. It really wasn't ready before Donald Trump. And even today, it's struggling to adjust to a party, the Republican Party, that is norm busting. You know, it just doesn't play by the same normal rules of engagement that parties and the Republican Party has played all along. It's crazy if you go back to Watergate and you look at Richard Nixon's resignation and you realize, like, you know, he met with people from both parties, like there was like this, there was much more of a respect for bipartisan leadership back then. And it's, you know, whereas today, Congress just seems so dysfunctional by comparison.
Make a little aside, and if you can not tap the table when you're talking, you're getting a little boom. Sure. From that. Yeah. I feel you. You bring up a good thing, which is a good point, which is the kind of role of the audience in talking back to us as the media, right? And that's even something in the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics that we're supposed to do that. One of the things that I've seen fairly recently, there's been some audience pushback against what kind of on social media they called sane washing, right? Which was taking meandering thoughts and, you know, things politicians are saying that are going like all over the place and kind of paraphrasing those to extract a single meaning. So it sounds like the person said something in a clear and straightforward way when in fact they did not. This is something I definitely would have done as a reporter. I was taught to do that in journalism school. I've taught students to do this in the past. I'm wondering how we get out of that kind of issue. Like, do you think the media has done damage in this practice, or how do we fix this?
Well, you know, here again, this is the norm has been to help readers understand the politician. So, well, what's the politician trying to say is what we would say to reporters. And then they'd be like, well, he's trying to say he's gonna cut taxes, you know, or he's not gonna outlaw abortion. Okay, we'll just say that, you know, don't put this confusing long paragraph where he meanders and says crazy things. And that's the way we've operated for a long time. That's the norm. But it disguises the truth, which is that, or at least a possible truth, that those long meandering paragraphs indicate something about this candidate that voters need to know about. So by cherry picking a few words from that long meandering paragraph, we distort the reality for people. So I think that's a that's a legitimate thing to consider and reflect in news coverage. But again, it gets back to norms. Like, we didn't worry about this that long ago, you know? But this situation is not normal. You know, by the same token, like, this president is threatening to lock people up in lots of ways. That's not normal. Like, you know, candidates don't do that as a general rule. And I don't know, I'm waiting to see the list of all the people that he's threatened to lock up.
For sure. I'm going to shift gears just a little bit. At one point in the book, you note that overconfident news consumers are more likely to fall prey to bad information. So the more you think you're resistant, the more likely you are to fall to it. And I saw a new study by the same authors that suggests it works in the other direction as well, right? So that being exposed to fake news makes you overconfident in sort of your judgment. But according to those articles, you know, one of which you cited in the book, 3/4 of Americans are overconfident. And that seems like a real problem. So what does this suggest that we should be doing when it comes to judging the quality of information?
Well, you know, the answer to that is always media literacy. We should be teaching people how to consume better information. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be scalable or particularly effective. So I think the jury is still out on what we can and should do. That low quality information, you know, the most effective way to stop people from, and of course, often it's people who are elderly, who don't have a good sense of the difference of different kinds of news sources. But the best way often to steer them to better news sources is a trusted relative or friend. But how do we do that at scale? That's difficult. So that's a little bit beyond my expertise as a political reporter.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, so this is the last question, but I felt like I had to get this in here. So according to your book, Mike Pence was your neighbor for quite some time. And during the course of your sort of relationship with him, you got to see him change in the way that he treated people and in the way kind of that he treated truth as he became more prominent in politics. I almost get the feeling that for a lot of the people that you talk about in the book, there is a kind of a utilitarian disregard for the truth, which is just part of the price you pay for getting and maintaining power. It seems like the audience for information still has some recourse here, though. And you do go through a bunch of ideas in the last chapter, and I'm going to save most of those because I want people to get the book and, you know, read them for themselves. But if you had to give one takeaway to my audience, what do you suggest that audiences can do to discourage newsmakers from lying?
Ooh, that's a great question. I would say it's one simple thing, which is to challenge. I think if enough people, this gets to something that Kevin Madden, a Republican strategist, said. And sort of playing on the old, you know, if enough people stand up, that's what creates social change. I think if enough people just say to an elected official, hey, I saw that you got, the fact checker said you got something wrong. You know, that really bothered me. You should, you know, you need to get those things right. And I think if enough people do that, it really affects politicians. They lie because they think it helps them. But if enough people say, hey, that didn't win me over, and the fact that you were called out on it bothers me, I think it truly can make a dent. I'm not saying it'll cure lying, but I think it can make a dent and get politicians to think twice the next time they lie.
Okay, that is a great area to end on. I really, really appreciate your time today, Bill, and I look forward to everybody getting your book.
Amanda, thank you. Thanks so much. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks for getting Unspun with me this week. Unspun is a production of me, Amanda Sturgill, and is a proud member of the MSW Media family of podcasts. Send me your thoughts and ideas about trickery in the news on Gmail at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. I even write back. And find this episode's show notes and more information at theunspunpodcast.substack.com. Want to learn more and get smarter? Check out my book, Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News, which is available on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And until next time, stay sharp, everyone. It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.